Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Wayne Pacelli. Wayne is the president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States, which is mobilizing its millions of members on behalf of the well-being of animals. Under Wayne's leadership, the Humane Society has, in just the last decade, helped to pass more than 25 federal statutes to protect animals. Wayne is author of The Bond, Our Kinship with Animals, Our Call to Defend Them. He's been profiled in major newspapers and magazines and has appeared on Good Morning America, The Today Show, and many other programs. His work and his leadership in the Humane Society of the United States place Wayne at the forefront of the movement to restore compassion and decency to the human-animal relationship. So now, Wayne, my dad and I are so grateful for your work, and we're so happy that we get to have this time with you. And for the interview, I'm now going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean, and thank you, Wayne, for being here with us and for your work. I want to start by mentioning a recent poll that I saw, which found that more than 90% of Americans, a very high percentage of Americans to agree on anything, agreed that animals raised for meat should be treated decently. Meanwhile, upwards of 99% of all the animals eaten in this country come from factory farms. Among the things, the many things I most appreciate about the Humane Society are your efforts to end the cruel confinement of animals in factory farms. Can you tell us why that matters to you?
Well, John and Ocean, thanks for inviting me to participate in the Food Revolution Summit. I'm so excited that you are bringing together so many different voices who are concerned about our food supply with all of its implications for us as individuals and for the planet. John, you ask about the confinement issues and you cite the polling numbers as well as the prevalence of factory farming. And I'm always struck by the remarkable disconnect that exists between what people want, which is decent treatment of animals, and what they're getting, which is miserable treatment of animals on today's industrialized farms. We at HSUS take a pluralistic approach. We've been devoted to people thinking about their food choices, and among our ranks are many vegans and vegetarians, and I've been one for nearly 30 years. But we also have a lot of people who associate with the Humane Society of the United States who eat a traditional American diet, and that includes a lot of animal products. And we want those folks thinking about making better choices. And I thought that one of the things that could unite all of us, whether folks are determined vegans or inveterate carnivores or somewhere in between, is an abhorrence of the idea of lifelong confinement of animals on factory farms, a sort of confinement where the animals are immobilized in cages or crates barely larger than their bodies, that deny animals one of the most basic opportunities to live a decent life, which is to move. So we've been working hard to ban veal crates and gestation crates, which are the 2-foot by 7-foot cages that breeding sows are housed in, as well as battery cages, which are the confinement cages that laying hens are jammed into, 6 or 8 birds into the size of a file cabinet drawer. Some of the members of those industries don't even meet the industry standard is 67 square inches each bird, which is about 2/3 the size of an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper.
The cruelty that you're talking about is not just that the animals who are destined for human consumption are butchered for meat or slaughtered the minute they cease to be profitable in the production of milk or eggs. It's not just that they're killed. You're talking about the kind of lives they live and the misery they are forced to endure throughout their entire lives in these confinement systems. In response, I know that HSUS promotes eating with a conscience and embraces the 3 R's, reducing, refining, and replacing. Can you explain what those mean?
Sure, John. 3 R's was a concept that was really developed on the animal testing and research realm, but we thought it applied well also to the issue of animals raised for food. And the three R's are refining, which essentially means trying to raise the animals in a way that doesn't cause them so much pain and suffering and subjects them to so much cruelty. And that's where the anti-crating or anti-confining campaign efforts are directed, making the lives of these animals a little bit better so that they can, you know, go on from day to day without suffering so many privations. The second R is reducing. I mean, we are raising in the United States alone 9 billion animals for food every year. The global number is upwards of 70 billion, and that's just for the land animals. This excludes the aquatic animals. And that means that for every animal raised for food, they are going through some sort of production practice. And if they are in a factory farm, that means just an endless amount of suffering for them. So these numbers combined with the duration of the suffering really add up to a serious moral problem for us in our society. So we've said at the very least, we can't sustain this level of animal rearing and this level of animal consumption. I mean, the average American eats more than 200 pounds of meat per year. And if we just went, say, to Meatless Monday and abstained from eating animal products at least one day a week and then didn't compensate by eating more the other 6 days or remainder of the week, then we could save 15% of the animals, which is, you know, 1.3 or 1.4 billion animals, which means that much less in the way of grain inputs into this animal agriculture system. It means less diversion of water. It means less in the way of antibiotic applications, lacing the feed and water. It means that much less in the way of greenhouse gas emissions from these animal factories. So reduction was the second R. And third is replace, that we're not confined by our palate or by our biology to eat animal products to survive. We can have plant-based proteins and other plant-based foods that satisfy our every desire, whether it's biochemistry or calories or taste. We've got so many incredible facsimiles these days from some of these plant-based proteins like Gardein or Beyond Meat. Now Hampton Creek Foods is doing Beyond Eggs. So the third piece is that replace. So refining, reducing, replacing, and doing it at a pace that's comfortable for people, but also recognizes the moral imperative for us to make some adjustments because the current system is so problematic from an animal welfare perspective, environmental, personal health, and then broader public health imperatives.
Some of your undercover videos have shocked the nation and have led to substantial changes. I'm thinking of a few years ago when you exposed appalling abuse that was taking place at the Bushway calf slaughter plant in Vermont. And then late last year, your investigators took undercover footage at the Catelli Brothers slaughterhouse in New Jersey that eventually prompted the USDA to shut down the plant for what was shown to be egregiously inhumane handling of calves. In both of these plants, one in Vermont, one in New Jersey, calves were involved. What did your undercover videos show, and what did you hope to achieve, and what did you achieve by exposing this abuse?
Well, John and Ocean, we are deeply disconnected, most of us, from the food supply. And in terms of the animal agriculture operations, both the production facilities and the slaughter facilities, they are removed from our daily gaze. Most of them are in rural areas. Most of them are now confinement operations, and they are really nondescript warehouse-looking facilities. They might as well have wine bottles or boxes or storing something else. In this case, they happen to be raising animals in them. And the slaughterhouses are places where we would normally avert our gaze. I mean, the last place you'd want to go is a slaughterhouse because it is a very unpleasant enterprise wherever you are emotionally on these issues. I mean, seeing other creatures killed should not be something that any of us is drawn to. So one of the things that we do at HSUS is we try to close that gap between what we believe and what's happening on the ground, and also to really provide a window into what's happening in our food production system. And unpleasant as it may be to look at, it is a moral imperative that we do so. Our actions have consequences. Our behavior touches the lives of so many animals. I mean, we have 8 million animals entering American animal shelters, dogs and cats every year, 8 million. And unfortunately, we're still euthanizing 3 million of those animals. But we have 9 billion animals entering into American slaughterhouses every year. And if we're serious about fighting animal cruelty, and if we're serious about having responsibilities to animals, we've got to take a look. And that's what our undercover investigators do. They do it at great risk. They do so even though the industry doesn't want people to see. And these investigations, whether it's the Bushway plant in Vermont that was shuttered, or the Catelli operation in New Jersey, or our undercover investigations at the Hallmark Westland plant that showed horrendous abuses of cattle, really spent dairy cows who could not walk and were dragged into the slaughterhouse or had water hoses put in their mouth to cause them such distress that they tried to get away from their tormentors and they would then direct them into the kill box at a slaughter plant. Or our investigations of Tyson facilities or Smithfield facilities raising breeding sows for production purposes. All of these things are part of the narrative now in our society, and part of the critique that I think is really resonating with Americans, that people don't want to see animals mistreated. They don't want to see harsh treatment of animals in the food production system. And people of conscience won't tolerate it. But the reason that we have tolerated it is because we've been so disconnected, and we're trying to now create a connection.
When you say that people don't want to see these types of abuses take place, I hear two meanings to that term. One is they don't want it to happen. They don't want it to occur. And secondly, they don't want to be exposed to it. They don't want to have it imposed on them. They want to shy away. They want to keep away from it. They want to avert their eyes. Those two meanings of the phrase are actually in dissonance with each other. And it seems to me that when you provide undercover investigations and bring forth the footage from them, if people are willing to look at them, they see what they don't want to see happen. They see that it is happening. And this has an enormously powerful effect, because what is shown, what is in fact taking place on a daily basis out of our view, is so horrific. I'm thinking now of one of your most recent undercover investigations where you exposed practices at the ironically named Iron Maiden Hog Farm in Owensboro, Kentucky. The Iron Maiden, of course, was a medieval torture device. It's the name of the facility. Your footage shows animals locked in cages so small they can't even turn around for essentially their entire lives. And perhaps most alarmingly, it shows sows being fed the ground-up intestines from dead piglets. These piglets were just left to die, often suffering for days, from a highly contagious disease with severe diarrhea, and then their intestines were ground up and routinely fed back to breeding females, possibly to their own mothers. I know this is only the latest in a series of undercover exposés you've brought to the public of the largely hidden horrors of the industrial pig industry. What's most significant about this recent investigation?
Well, John, I was elected by our board of directors to serve as CEO, a great privilege. And when I was interviewed and when I was discussing the possibility of this job, I told our board of directors, I said, we as a nation must look at the food production system and the treatment of animals in food production if we're serious about taking a look at animal protection in our society. I mean, the Humane Society of the United States is an animal protection group. And if you do not have a focus on the biggest category of animals at risk, the animals raised for food, then you're really missing the boat. I think you framed it well, John, that the public doesn't like cruelty. They don't want to do this. But at the same time, it's much more convenient not to confront these realities. You know, you look at the sweep of American history, and change is the watchword. I mean, we're not the society that we were 25 years ago, 50, certainly not 100 or 150 years ago. I mean, we're a nation that went through the incredible churn and violence of a fight over slavery. We denied women the right to vote for, you know, nearly 150 years after the founding of the Republic. We went through bouts and challenges with child labor. We've continued to struggle with civil rights issues in our lifetimes, yours and mine, John. We've seen incredible change in the civil rights issues. Well, we've got to confront this issue of animal protection and animal welfare. This powerful agribusiness industry has been able to keep things as they want them to be, and they have conveniently moved their operations into places that make them difficult to view, and now they want to block the American public from seeing the results of our investigation by passing these so-called ag gag laws to criminalize our taking video or photographs of animals on these farms. And what we found at the Iron Maiden operation in Owensboro, Kentucky was just a hellhole. I mean, the routine abuses were unconscionable in terms of the mistreatment of the sows. And then you layer that over with this disease that overtook the barns and resulted in 100% of the piglets dying miserable deaths from this disease that induces diarrhea. And then to see the animals ground up and then fed back to the sows, with the mothers in some cases being fed their own progeny. I mean, this is not a pleasant picture. And as difficult as it is for us to confront, just like it was difficult for us as a nation to confront these other social problems that we had, and the denial of women the right to vote or civil rights problems. I mean, we went through a real churn on those issues, and people don't want to change, and they get used to doing things the way that it had been happening for decades. But we had to confront those difficult problems because it was a moral imperative, because the values that drive our nation mean something. They're not platitudes. Principles of fairness and principles of justice. And of course, you know, more contemporary notions embedded in the law, such as opposition to animal cruelty, if they mean anything, they must be applied to all animals. I mean, a pig feels like a dog, or a chicken feels like a duck or a goose. If these things matter to us, and they should and they must, then we've got to logically pursue this line of thought and this line of argument, and then conform our beliefs with our behavior. And that's what we're trying to do, is ask people to live by the credos that they hold dear.
I know some people will speak to me of being afflicted with compassion fatigue. There's so much pain in the world, and there's so many causes that are deserving of attention and support, but we can be overwhelmed and even go numb or shut down to it. And they will then say, you know, I can only care about so many things, and so I start to stay with people, and that's where I draw my circle of compassion, and even that is extending me beyond what I can bear. And I said, well, I understand that, and we all have the limitations of our resources and our capacities, but it's also true that when you immobilize pigs, for example, in gestation crates, when you immobilize animals in the conditions of factory farms, layer hens in cages, battery cages that you mentioned earlier, veal calves, when you immobilize animals, it creates tremendous stress in that animal, and it creates the ideal conditions for diseases to spread. Hence, at the Iron Maiden facility, this disease that was killing all the piglets. Hence, many, many diseases that spread like wildfire through factory farms. And this is why the industry uses so much on antibiotics. They don't use them to treat sick animals. They mix them into every meal the animals eat throughout their lives as a preventative and a growth promotant. 80% of the antibiotics used in this country are not used as medicine to treat human illness. They're given to livestock and factory farms. This then is a driving force behind the proliferation of antibiotic-resistant bacteria that is undermining the efficacy of the medicines that we as human beings depend upon to treat microbial and pathogenic illness in our population. So there's a direct link. The more cruelly the animals are treated, the less healthy those animals are, the more stressed they are, the more unnatural the conditions in which they're forced to live, then the sicker they are and the more drugs have to be used to keep them alive and profitable for the industry. And then the more antibiotic-resistant bacteria we have, the more residues from those drugs end up in the meats, dairy products, and eggs people are eating. It seems we're connected to these animals and the quality of their lives in ways we often don't recognize.
No question about it, John. We are all tied to what's going on in the world, and of course we're tied to the food we eat. I think that you have it exactly right on the public health issues and the personal health issues, that what we put into our bodies and what we put into the animals who we're then eating matters. This is relevant, and obviously self-interest is a powerful motivator, and when you learn about the cost of this cheap meat in our society, then you've got to take an honest look at it, if not for the whole of society, then for your own health and well-being. I do hear this argument about compassion fatigue and so many other issues, and I certainly see that, and we all have our limits. I do think that the pluralism of concerns in society is important. I mean, I'm glad there are people who are fighting diseases from spreading or working to cure diseases. And I'm glad there are people fighting for the environment. And I'm glad there are people fighting against poverty or against hunger. All of these things add up. And the fact that so many different people have these passions, it all adds up to a civil society. And I think that's a great mark of our society. But the concern for animal cruelty and the miserable treatment that exists in so many different industries is also a matter of moral concern. And I think also, John, very importantly, it's something we can act upon every day. I mean, I believe in democracy and the spread of democratic principles. I can't do much about that personally when it comes to what's going on in Syria or Libya or other, you know, hot spots in the world. I mean, I can believe it, but it's thousands of miles away. I'm not a citizen of those nations. There's not much I can do. I can fret. I can read up on it. But every one of us, if we're lucky enough, we're sitting down two or three times a day to a meal. And when we do so, we're wittingly or unwittingly, we're presented with moral choices. And simple things that we can do that really hardly cause us any inconvenience and don't diminish our quality of life and actually can probably prolong or extend our lives by making the right choices, have enormous consequences for animals. So I think it's a little bit of a cop-out for people to say, well, you know, I'm just concerned about people and, you know, I don't have time or energy for animals. Well, you're making a decision, whether you realize it or not, every time you sit down. And simple things go a long way for animal. You don't need to devote your life to it. You don't need to give a lot of your money to it if it's not your passion. But I think the mark of an informed person living in a civil society is to make responsible choices. And one of those choices on a regular basis that you make is, you know, what is on your plate and how are you responding to this moral crisis of factory farming in our nation?
You know, I don't think we have a limited supply of compassion, a set amount that we can spend in certain areas and not in others. I think it's more of a flow, and when we're in that flow, our heartfulness with which we live can grow. My experience is that most people who are concerned about the welfare of animals and take crimes against animals seriously and try to bring their lives into alignment with their compassion in their relationship to animals are actually more sensitive to, more compassionate to human suffering in other ways also. I don't find them less so because they care about animals. I actually think they tend to be more so. At least that's my experience. I don't think you have to be a vegetarian or an animal rights activist to find what's done to animals in factory farms horrifying. And I'm thinking right now about another undercover video that you released. This one was taken in Wyoming at Premium Farms in Wheatland. It was horrible to watch. employees were shown striking mother pigs with their fists and kicking them and swinging sick piglets in circles by their hind legs and kicking live piglets. The report spoke of workers who cut the testicles off of male piglets and then fed them to the piglets' mothers. When I saw this, I hoped it would persuade the Wyoming legislature to enact stricter laws and penalties for what really is the torture of livestock. And indeed, the video was the spark for legislation, but it was not the kind I had hoped for, because almost immediately a state representative, a woman named Sue Wallace, who has since passed on, sponsored a bill that would put those convicted in jail for up to 6 months, but the perpetrators of animal cruelty weren't her target. If her measure passed, the people punished would have been the ones who shot the video of farm workers' criminal acts. Thankfully, her bill did not pass, but similar bills called ag gag bills, you made mention of them a moment ago, have been proposed in many states, have passed in some. Wayne, talk to us about these ag gag bills.
Well, John, you're right, and how shocking the political response to our investigation of premium farms in Wyoming not to immediately rush a bill into the legislative process and to address the problems that our investigation uncovered, but to essentially try to cover up the whole thing for the future so that we couldn't do a similar investigation. I mean, this is the problem, that agribusiness has had a vice grip on the political process for too long, and the lawmaking process has lagged very badly indeed for animals on farms because of that vice grip, not because of science, not because of reason, not because of economic benefit, but simply the application of political muscle and power. And as we get more successful and as we advance tactics that resonate more and more powerfully with the American public, there is a backlash and an attempt to block those tools from being used. I remember, John, when we were doing so many ballot measures, and we still do them, to, you know, stop cruel confinement of animals or to stop the use of steel jaw traps or bear baiting or other unacceptable activities, many of the states tried to raise the requirement on signature gathering to lift the number of signatures so high that it would be impossible for a grassroots organization like HSUS to get the signatures, or they would require a distribution requirement that you have to get X number of signatures in every county of the state, including the most rural counties where there aren't enough people really to gather that many signatures. You know, we saw this attempt to block the ballot initiative process. We now are seeing this ag-gag effort as the success of these investigations, success in the sense that we've documented problems and the American public demands reform, like in our Hallmark investigation in Southern California and the abuse of downer cows that led to President Obama drafting and finalizing a rule to ban the slaughter of downer cattle in the food supply. The industry doesn't want to confront these issues. They don't want to see these reforms, and they're trying to cover it up. And it's a very serious problem. Idaho just passed an ag gag law last year in 2013. There were 11 states that considered the bill. We were able to block them in all those states, but this year already Idaho has passed one, and we're fighting ag gag proposals in a number of other states.
Governor Butch Otter, Idaho governor, signed that bill into law in February of this year, and it's a law that makes it illegal for whistleblowers to expose abusive practices at Idaho's factory farms, and it imposes fines and jail time on activists who secretly film that abuse. Do you think this legislation in Idaho came about as a response to the undercover video of animal abuse by workers at Betancourt Dairy Farms, which actually included the sexual abuse of cows?
Yeah. Now, it's a national movement, and sometimes it's disconnected from any particular investigation. But in Wyoming, where you mentioned Sue Wallace's bill, and in Idaho, where you mentioned the Betancourt investigation, you can draw a clear line between the actual investigation and the introduction of legislation to prevent that sort of thing. And, you know, I mean, what a terrible thing this is 317 million Americans, all of them relying on our food production system, whether it's animal agriculture or it's horticulture or some other form of food raising. We all have a stake in this. We all have a stake in this. Nothing is more relevant to the American public than where their food comes from. Why would we make it more difficult to expose problems? If there's no problem, there's no expose. You can take perfectly boring footage of animals being treated decently, and no one's going to get in a lather about it. The only reason you'd want to cover it up is if you're trying to hide something.
Well, they do seem to be continually trying to find new ways to keep activists from effectively exposing what's taking place. You mentioned ballot measures a moment ago and how they sometimes try to make those harder to get on the ballot. It's now 2014, and next year, California's Proposition 2 will go into effect. And this is a ballot measure that, with major support from HSUS, was passed by California voters in 2008 by a wide margin that requires chicken farmers, as of next year, to give their egg-laying birds enough room to stand and spread their wings. What will this mean for the hens whose eggs are sold in the state of California?
You know, John, Proposition 2 was a landmark ballot measure, a November 2008 initiative that put before the people of California the notion that certain farm animals, veal calves, breeding sows, laying hens, they should have the opportunity to lie down, stand up, turn around, and freely extend their limbs. Hardly a radical proposition, but a basic sort of behavioral standard that is a common sense standard. That measure was fought vigorously by the egg industry and by the pork industry and the cattle industry and the Farm Bureau, and nearly 64% of California voters favored it, proving this idea that the vast majority of people, when presented with a reform to make the lives of animals in the food production system better, will go for it, and enthusiastically so. In fact, of all California ballot initiatives in history up until that time, Prop 2 got more votes than any one of them. I mean, there were measures on developing hospitals and child protection and so many different issues, and this got the most votes. So I think an amazing marker. It had a six-year phase-in, and it's set to take effect January 1st, 2015. And, of course, now it's facing legal assaults from the Missouri Attorney General and from other forces, because in the follow-up to Prop 2, state lawmakers passed a measure, they enacted a law, that says that if you want to sell eggs in California, you've got to meet the standards that are being observed by in-state producers. So it wasn't setting up a differential standard, but to have a consistent standard, and to say that if an egg farmer in Fresno has to give the animals enough space to turn around, then so does an egg farmer in Iowa who wants to sell into that market. If you don't want to do that, and if Iowa allows you to miserably confine an animal, then you can sell that somewhere else, but not to California. It had a kind of moral consistency as a driver, but also a food safety rationale. There have been 20 major studies that look at the issue of confinement of hens, and there is greater salmonella shedding and an incidence of salmonella in these extreme confinement operations compared to more extensive systems. So we are in good shape on the underlying law being enforced in January, saying that those animals have to be able to exhibit that behavior. But we're facing challenges from attorneys general and from industry, kind of working on behalf of the industry, to undercut that sales standard. And it's a very important principle. Why should California be forced to take eggs from hens who are terribly confined in other states? What if 49 states adopted a Prop 2 standard, and one state, because it was in the grip of the agribusiness interest, was confining hens in 48-inch allotments and producing unsafe eggs, and, of course, inhumanely treated birds? under the Commerce Clause, would California have to allow those eggs to come in? I mean, it really just undercuts the notion of states' rights and the decision-making of a legislature or the electorate through the initiative process. So we're going to fight it with everything we've got because we believe in Prop 2 and we believe in the follow-up law that the state legislature enacted.
Well, we thank you for that, and it points to me to the need or how great it would be if there was a federal law like Prop 2, but the citizens of some of the states and the legislators elected by those citizens aren't likely to enact that. I know that HSUS and the United Egg Producers, longtime adversaries, have remarkably joined forces to lobby for federal legislation that would set national standards for egg production. Why are the United Egg Producers agreeing to work with you on legislation, federal legislation, that would provide each hen essentially double her current space and that would also create a national egg labeling program so consumers would have more information in the marketplace?
I think it really stems from Prop 2. I think the battle over Prop 2 where the agribusiness groups and mainly the egg industry spent $10 million to try to defeat it was a wake-up call. They realized that the public was not aligned with them on these extreme confinement practices, that they were buying the product because they didn't have much of a choice. It was out of sight, out of mind. But once presented with the information, the public said, of course we want to favor a more animal protective policy, and we want to see the animals treated more decently on the farms. And I think the United Egg Producers, which is the National Trade Association of the egg industry, realized this is where the market's going. This is the future for our industry. Isn't it going to be better if we can be involved in those deliberations rather than have something imposed on us? And isn't it better to have a national policy rather than a state-by-state patchwork of policies that are driven by, you know, different political considerations? And when you've got a national commodity that's moving across state lines like eggs do, you want some uniformity. Amazingly enough, John, it was the cattle industry and the pork industry that fought this vigorously in Congress and thus far have stymied the enactment of the legislation. These other sectors of animal agriculture don't want to see a precedent for animal welfare. They don't want to see the egg industry improve its standards in the law because then they think, well, logically, people are going to say, well, shouldn't we have standards? Shouldn't we do better when it comes to animals? I think it's a disgraceful circumstance. I think that the American public really needs to see the cruelty that's going on in some of these industries, especially the pork industry, and how they're obstructing progress even in other sectors. I mean, I think it's a big story that needs to come out.
Well, I agree. And with pork industry, of course, the gestation crates are one of the real big issues. You have been raising this issue time and time again. McDonald's has said now that they won't buy pork from processors and facilities that use gestation crates. Other big players are joining. But still, at this point, I believe something like 95% of the sows in the country are still in gestation crates. Do you see progress? Has progress happened? Are we about to see progress?
You know, we've had in the United States 60 major food retailers, McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, Safeway, Costco, Cracker Barrel. I mean, the biggest names in the food business have said they want to get out of the gestation crate business. They don't want this as part of their supply chain. And I think it's inevitable that gestation crates are going to be ended in the United States. It's just a question of, is it going to take 3 years or 5 years or 10 years or God forbid longer. I think that the debate is settled. The public's views on this are crystal clear. You now just have the obstinate actions of the industry that are really preventing a very rapid resolution of this problem for our society. I think we've got to continue to push on this issue because the situation is just awful for these animals, and we understand the real life economic circumstances of farmers, but there's no future in this. Now is the time to transition. You're going to have a better outcome if you align your production practices with the values of your consumers. When you're misaligned and you're producing a product that the public thinks is inhumanely produced, that it's dangerous, it's environmentally destructive, how is that a good business strategy? It's not a good business strategy, but, you know, we've seen historically that people are loath to change. They don't want to be told what to do, but the history of our country is forward progress on the big moral issues of the day.
Well, when McDonald's and Burger King and the United Egg Producers are agreeing that certain steps are necessary, it shows that this is a cause whose time has truly arrived. And I want to thank you, really, for your years of service to the cause of bettering the lives of all animals, including those whose flesh, milk, and eggs some of us eat. Mahatma Gandhi once famously said that the greatness of a nation can be judged by the way its animals are treated. If that's the case, you're a true patriot, because you're helping to bring our country into more coherence with the compassion that lives in every human heart. It's been an honor to speak with you, Wayne. You're an inspiration to me, as you are to millions. On behalf of all of our listeners, and on behalf of all of the animals who would not have a voice if it weren't for you and others like you, I thank you.
Well, thank you. What a generous spirit. I'm so glad to play a small part in this important food revolution summit, and I wish you the best, and obviously the best for all of the listeners.
We've been talking with Wayne Pacelli, President and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States and author of The Bond. Wayne, your work is effective, and it is helping not only to improve the well-being of animals, it's also helping to restore our humanity. It's been a privilege to share this time with you, and we thank you for your work and for your partnership in the food revolution.
Thanks very much.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 23 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then we have an offer to share. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus resources. If you like, you can also get CDs, members-only courses, and a lot more. This empowerment package is available for a major discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thanks so much for joining us in the Food Revolution. Now we have a pre-recorded message from one of our past summit participants, Charisse Scally, age 48, from Spring, Texas. This is Charisse's story in her own words.
Hello, my name is Charisse Scally, and I want to share my food revolution story. I am 48 years old, and after adopting a whole food lifestyle in 2011, I have been diabetes-free for almost 3 years. I attended school to get certifications in nutrition and health coaching so that I could help others do what I have done. I suffered from type 2 diabetes for almost 12 years as a result of gestational diabetes that took the life of my preterm daughter in November 99 at 26 weeks gestation. It almost took my life too. After I discovered the power of raw whole foods and adopted a veganish lifestyle, my life changed almost overnight. My diabetes was gone, I was healthy, in shape, down 40 pounds, and I haven't looked back. The Food Revolution Summit has been an important part of my continuing journey. It reinforces what I learned on my journey to reverse my diabetes, and it gives me the tools to help my clients. I value the information that the summit has to offer, and I share it with everyone who will listen. In December 2011, I became a grandmother. Thanks to being diabetes-free, I have a wonderful life ahead of me, and I am enjoying every moment of it. I love to share my story, and I hope it will inspire others to do what I have done and know that it's possible to be diabetes-free. I wish you the best on your journey.
If you would like to engage with other summit participants with your questions, your comments, or your reactions, We invite you to post and connect in the comments section at the bottom of our broadcast page. As always, you'll need to refresh the page so you can read the latest comments. Our next presentation will be an interview with influential author Jonathan Safran Foer that will start at the top of the hour. Until then, here's some more music from our friend, Bruce Beckvar. Thank you.
Thank you.